The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr in Ramallah. Professor Nimr, 145 Democratic lawmakers have said they're alarmed that an American president would advocate for the forcible removal and permanent displacement of around 2 million people and have called on President Donald Trump to take back his, quote, dangerous Gaza takeover comments. How do you view this stance by the Democratic Party, which, in fact, is and has always been a staunch supporter of Israel?
Well, there are many things here to talk about in this respect. First of all, we have to understand that Trump's decision to ethnically cleanse Gaza has three indications. The first one, ethnically cleanse Gaza, it means this is a crime against the humanity. It's a human crime, war crime, considered. The second thing, that the most of the world countries are against this kind of decision because it is, you know, not right, and it's unacceptable by even Europeans, by even their allies to the Americans, apart from maybe a few countries who, including Emirates, who are, you know, supporting this kind of scheme. And the third thing, which is also important, it will fire back to the American society if he go on with this kind of decision. That will harm the American interest in the area, and that might be, you know, a kind of a consequences that would be very bad on the American itself. I think that the Democrats, they realize that, and they realize that they are going to lose lots of their friends, and they will enter lots of problems. So we have these 145 of the Democrats who voted against, or they signed this petition against the decision by Trump, trying, you know, to calm him down a little bit. I believe, anyway, that in the last 2 days, 3 days only, we can say that there is a little bit of climbing down, not by Trump personally, but by others like Rubio. He said that we are now waiting to see the plan coming out from the Arab summit in Saudi Arabia, and after that we will see. And I think this kind of statement, it means that now they are open to hear other suggestions, with none of them is containing the evacuation of the population in Gaza. So it started, I think, to climb down generally. And I believe, anyway, that this plan, even whether the Americans started to understand that it's impossible and it's not going to happen. It's not about the place where to put the Palestinians, whether in Egypt or in Jordan, but it's rather no one asked the Palestinians about this whole issue, as if the Palestinians just, you know, with no voice, with no action, and they are just waiting for Trump to come and say, yeah, go from here, and they will go. This is not true. The Israelis, they tried for 15 months to evacuate the Palestinians from Gaza, and they failed. And not only that, for more than 3 months, they tried in north of Gaza, in Beit Lahia, Jabalia, and all these areas, and they considered to evacuate it totally in what was known that, at that time, the general's plan. And yet they failed, by the military. No one, you know, some people left north of Gaza, but others who stayed there and refused to move.
Mr. Frahughes, the world has reacted angrily to the U.S. plan to forcefully displace the Palestinians out of Gaza to other countries. The U.N. Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Francesca Albanese, has called Trump's proposal grotesque and insulting. Also, according to a recent poll, most Americans even oppose the plan as well. Given all the international outrage and all the global support that Palestinians receive throughout the duration of this genocidal war, it seems that Trump's America First policy has quickly morphed into Israel first, hasn't it?
I thought for a second you were going to say Donald Trump first, because this smacks of the whole ego and maniacal kind of psychology that appears to be Donald Trump in person. I think what we're witnessing here is it's possible that this has been, don't forget, for the 6 months before he came into power, there would have been a shadow administration. I'm sure he was in talks with people in the background. I'm sure he didn't just wake up one morning with Netanyahu and go, hey, I know what, let's just clear them all out. Let's rebuild. Let's have this Las Vegas on the Mediterranean. But when you talk about these 145 lawmakers, Democrats, what struck me very strongly is they don't want 2 million Palestinians forcibly removed from Gaza, but they were happy when their leader, their president, murdered and injured up to 200,000 people. That's 10% of the population. They didn't seem to have a problem when the Israelis corralled the people of Gaza. They blocked off the Philadelphia corridor, therefore preventing any Palestinians from fleeing. They then herded them like cattle. They bombed them from place to place to place to place, claiming they were safe havens while they continued to murder people with a genocidal onslaught. And a short, quick glance at the internet will tell you that there were between 500,000 and 1 million Iraqis killed during the war on Iraq by America. There are 7.2 million Syrians internally displaced, 5.5 million Syrians living abroad. From 2022, following the CIA MI6 coup in Kiev in 2014, there are 6 million Ukrainians living in Europe and 8 million Ukrainians internally displaced. We haven't even talked about Yemen. We haven't even talked about Afghanistan. American foreign policy has murdered more than 4.5 million people from the war on terror in inverted commas began in, after 9/11. So America doesn't follow international law. America creates intervention, war, destabilization of countries across the globe. And for Donald Trump to say, we'll just move 2 million, this is like a chess piece. This is just like numbers. These are like tenants already on his land. But as a hotelier and as a landlord, he just wants to potentially move these people out. Whether or not he can succeed, whether or not this is a bluff in order to bring in other powers in the region to send their troops to pacify the people of Gaza, which obviously the resistance won't accept. There may be more to this than we're seeing in the public domain, and that includes political speeches made by politicians who in public say something for the internal consumption of their own people and not necessarily are against Trump's plan.
Professor Nim, by proposing a plan that entails a full ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, has Donald Trump, in your views, effectively endorsed and legitimized the Israeli genocide in Gaza?
Absolutely. Yani by doing that and by even threatening the other day, if Hamas did not release the prisoners on Saturday, he's going to show them hell. What do he mean by that? Definitely, he's totally supporting the Israeli genocidal war in all means. But at the same time, he wanted to, when he reached to the White House, he don't want the problems there because he want to focus on more important issues from his point of view, which is the Ukraine war and also the China. And these two files are big files, and he want to finish them somehow. So he was not interested at that time to see the war going on. But now, after after the visit of Netanyahu to Washington and meeting with Trump, apparently there are some, you know, big support to Netanyahu in the White House and in Israel in whatever they are doing, including also giving like gifts to the right wing in Israel by some of the statements, such as, you know, that he might agree to annex parts of the West Bank. He wanted to, you know, show Gaza hell if they didn't hand over all the prisoners captive by the Palestinian resistance. So quite well that in Israel they have this idea that Trump is going to support them on all levels. And Netanyahu now is focusing with America on Iran particularly to try to either have a strike on Iran, and he wanted the American either to support him or to do it for him. So we don't know yet what's going on that level, but it's quite clear that Trump is supporting Israel in everything. He is the one who said that Israel area is very small and it needs to be enlarged. What does it mean to be enlarged? What does it mean that it is small? So to go to other countries, and we saw that perfectly when we are talking about, you know, what's going on in Syria. They occupied 500 kilometers. That's more than the size of Gaza, the Israelis. And now they are building some kind of centers there and camps for the army. Also in Lebanon, they are saying that in spite of the fact that the 2 months finished, for the stop the war to end the Israeli occupation, they said that we need some more time, and they got 18 days. And now after the 18 days, which is going to end next Tuesday, they are saying that there are 5 spots we don't want to leave, and we will continue to seize them and to occupy them. So it means that they have these ideas about enlarging really the perimeter of Israel, and all that in with the encouragement of Trump, because the Israeli said about Lebanon that the American are supporting us in the issue of staying in these 5 spots in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Also, Smotrich is talking about the eastern part of Jordan Valley, which is in Jordan particularly. So he wants also some part of Jordan to be annexed to Israel. All that comes especially after the elections in America, and Trump won, and he's totally supporting Israel.
Farah, he's looking at Trump's proposal from a legal standpoint. Does it violate international law, namely the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits the forcible transfer of protected populations?
Yes, well, as I've already maybe said, I don't think that the Americans, the American administration of the deep state care much for international law when you consider the threats that they made against the members of the ICC and the ICJ, and they threatened that they would actually attack The Hague in the Netherlands should American personnel ever be brought before the court for war crimes. But what we're witnessing here is it's maybe the global unmasking of the deep state of America. It's the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department and others, that they are involved not only in supporting Israel, but you could quite rightly claim that this is America's war in West Asia, because it's American fighter planes, it's American bombs, it's the 2,000, 5,000 pound munitions that are being dropped on people that are living homeless, refugees inside tents. So let's say this is America's war in Asia, and it's being run by Israel on behalf of the greater Israeli expansionist theology. And just on, if Trump, which I don't think he's going to be able to do this, but let's just play along for 1 second. If the people of Gaza were pushed into both the Sinai and into Jordan, that creates part of the greater Israel dream. Then you have Palestinians in Egypt and Palestinians in Jordan who will continue their lawful right to liberate their land in historic Palestine. So then you're going to have internal divisions within Egypt and Jordan between the security apparatus and the resistance fighters. Now, the Greater Israel Project has designs on the Sinai. It has designs on Jordan, as well as Lebanon, and even as far as Saudi Arabia. It means in 10 years' time that the Israelis could say, we are being attacked from Egypt, so they're going to go into the Sinai. We are being attacked from Jordan, so they're going to go into the Jordan. So on one level, all this fits perfectly with the greater Eretz Israel idea of expanding Israel beyond the borders of Palestine into its neighboring countries. And Donald Trump seems to have given the green light for many of these potentialities going forward to take place.
Right, Professor Nim, the U.S. has historically supported a two-state solution as the basis for peace. Does Trump's plan, even just suggesting it, officially signal an end to that policy in favor of total Israeli dominance over Palestinian lands?
Well, there is two factors here. The first one, that Israel, they took a decision in the Knesset, a law. Now it is by law in Israel that they prevent the establishment of any Palestinian state, regardless where or how. So no Palestinian state from the perspective of Israel. This is one thing. The other thing is that the statement of Trump recently, and he said there will be a solution for the Palestinian question, and that shouldn't, or it might not include the two-state solution or establishing a Palestinian state. So he wants to solve the Palestinian problem, but in a different way that will entail that there is no Palestinian state at all. However, I believe personally that the two-state solution, anyway, it's behind us now. Even if the international community and the Americans wanted the two-state solution, it became impossible with this large amount of settlers and settlements in the West Bank. We are talking about around more than 800,000 settlers. Who's going to take these settlements out from the West Bank and from Jerusalem? Who's going in Israel to recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine? Who's going even to think to discuss the issue of Palestinian refugees, the one that now under attack by the Israelis, especially in all refugee camps in the West Bank. So the idea of the two-state solution, I think it is behind us. No one is talking about it now in a serious way, apart from some Europeans and others, and even sometimes some Americans. But they do know that it became impossible. It's not a two-state solution, it's two-state illusion now. And but still, in spite of that, still, Trump says that not necessarily two states or Palestinian state. So I don't know what's going on in his mind to solve the Palestinian problem. Maybe part of this solving the Palestinian problem is by ethnically cleansing the Palestinians, not only from Gaza, but also from the West Bank. And in this case, he says that the Arab world, as the Israeli will say, Arab world is very big and very huge area. So let's move the Palestinian there. And they are all Arabs. So that's it. Period. Even Netanyahu's, when he said that Saudi Arabia should build a kind of a city for the Palestinians to accommodate them, that offended also even Saudi Arabia, that they are trying to normalize relation with them. But it showed the reality of the intentions of Israel. This Zionist movement is based on not only colonialism, but also based on hatred, on racism, and on violence.
Mr. Hughes, with Arab nations like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt rejecting the full displacement of Gazans, where does that leave regional support for the U.S.'s plan?
Well, what we're listening to is the public stated positions of Sisi, King Abdullah, and bin Salman, Mohammed bin Salman. So these are their public positions, which I believe are partly for internal consumption within their countries, because they know there'll be uprisings, there'll be millions of people on the streets that will have their hearts dead set against the forced relocation and ethnic cleansing of the people of Gaza. But I would be concerned as a Palestinian, it's just my own personal opinion, that when the Arab League gets together, unless they're going to stand together as one and say, this is not happening, end of discussion, that's it, finished, I believe that there will be enough leverage and pressure potentially put on some of these. I mean, Donald Trump's going to come to power and Saudi Arabia's given him $600 billion. I mean, what was that? A telephone call? Give us some money, help make America great again. Or is there something else in the background, this leverage around security? When we see what happened in Syria, that could happen. Sisi could be replaced in Egypt, because Sisi was installed, in my opinion, through a CIA, Mossad, MI6 coup. He was encouraged to get rid of Morsi. Morsi died in prison, the only democratically elected leader in Egypt in the last couple of decades. They could quite simply say to him, we're going to do to you what you did to Morsi, and you're out of the picture. And they could tell King Abdullah in Jordan, look what happened, President Assad. We just have to mix it up a wee bit. USAID and people that are involved in all these color revolutions, they could be used to destabilize Jordan. So it's not just political statements made in the public arena. I don't think any of us truly know of the pressure and the leverage that they have on these people that are in power in these other regions. And not one of the person that I've spoken about so far is a democratically elected person, elected with a mandate from the public. They're all dictators, they're all monarchs, they're all vulnerable, they're all looking to America for money, for military aid and political cover. And America could take that away at any time, and the whole place could just go up in smoke. It all depends, is Trump bluffing, or is he really, really, really trying to push this agenda forward?
Right, and Professor Nim, Palestinians in Gaza have also reacted with anger and rejection to Trump's comments. What would the U.S. and Israel do if Palestinians in Gaza, and also with that, in the West Bank, reject any forced relocation as they have resisted the occupation and the brutal wars in the past?
So far, the Israeli believe in one kind of method, which is to apply pressure and to apply force. And if it didn't work, more force and to apply more power and more pressure and more violence, basically. So that's how they are trying to deal with it. So they were very pleased with the plan of Trump, because that will end and eliminate all the possibilities of Hamas and the Palestinian resistance to continue in Gaza. Because the question that we always ask, okay, even if this war stopped now, how long it will be the next one to come? 5 years, 3 years, 4 years, we don't know. But as far as the soul of the problem, the origin of the problem is not solved, which is the existence of this kind of regime, it will continue, and the violence will continue in the whole Middle East, not only in Palestine and Gaza. Now, the people in Gaza, they express their ideas about the Trump's plan, and they took it in a kind of a joke. You know, because Israel, with all the mighty of Israel and the bombing of Israel and the genocidal war that they applied against the Gazans, they didn't move and they refused to move, even when there was offers to go to Sinai at the beginning of the war. Yeah, there is the fact that the Egyptians refused, but also the Palestinians refused. And we saw that quite clearly. The moment that the ceasefire was signed, 500,000 Palestinians went back from the south to the north. This like the picture now on your screen. This kind of people who were marching back to another destroyed area, but they say that we are winning and we are going back to our homes, regardless. And it's something they are attached to. They want to go back to where they lived for the last years, and where they built their houses, their neighbors, their friends. So they insisted on this, and they won't accept at all any kind of ethnically cleansing or moving out of Gaza Strip. This is quite clear, and I think this kind of reaction the Israeli do understand, because now the Israeli in media, quite obvious that after the Trump's statements about Gaza, nowadays it's coming down a lot. And they are talking about, you know, how we are going to do that, and this is impossible to be, executed.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, joining us from Ramallah. Thanks to journalist, author, and activist Frau Hughes, speaking to us from Belfast. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on this edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
We are believers and we have accepted Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight and I'm your host Mehdi. Please stay with us. يا إله كل شيء ومليكه Today's tip, what are the secrets of post-forgiveness process and its relation to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah? So, dear friends, we are humbly at your service talking about the post-forgiveness process. Now, in a previous episode, we talked about the pre-sin process and what one needs to do in order to prevent the commission and the committing of sins. And in one other episode, we talked about the actual process of seeking forgiveness. And in order to complete the discussion, and also because we had promised that we would talk about it, we want to talk a little bit about the post-forgiveness process and, of course, its integral and intimate relationship with our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So in the pre-sin process, we talked about what we can do in order to prevent ourselves from committing sin. In the seeking forgiveness process, we talked about how, if, God forbid, unfortunately, we have committed a sin, how do we seek forgiveness? Now, the post-forgiveness process is what one needs to do after they have sought the Almighty Allah's forgiveness. So just to kind of put all of these processes together, you know, we end up trying to not commit sin, you know, but unfortunately we end up committing a sin. Then we admit that we have committed a sin. Then we are regretful and ashamed, and then we ask for forgiveness. Now, after we ask for forgiveness is called the post-forgiveness process. Now, here in the post-forgiveness process, it's kind of similar to the pre-sin forgiveness process, in the sense where now that we have asked for forgiveness and we have also analyzed why it was that we fell into a certain sin, we have tried to prevent ourselves from committing that sin. At this point, you know, with hope that the Almighty Allah has forgiven us, and a little bit of fear that he might not forgive us because we are not deserving of that forgiveness, but still, because we have asked for forgiveness, we have that hope. So as the spiritual wayfaring masters have said, that hope and fear, hope in the forgiveness of the Almighty Allah, and fear that the disobedience that we have done is quite severe, this hope and fear together helps one fly. So just as a side note there. But this hope that the Almighty Allah has forgiven us, now we should feel light, we should feel purified, and we will. The Almighty Allah is the most quick to forgive. And now we have to once again see, you know, if we had done the pre-sin process where we had analyzed why we are falling into sin, and we see that despite doing that, we still committed the sin. Now we have to kind of recalibrate and regauge what it was that went wrong. You know, we have to realize, you know, where did we end up slipping again? That despite knowing the sin that we were committing and the sin that we were committing, why we were doing it, we tried to prevent it, but still we find that we fell into the sin again. So this is kind of a regauging and a remeasuring and a rebalancing of everything that happened. It's a constant work in process. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
We are believers and we have accepted Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We are intellectually convinced of the veracity of the Quran. That's not a question for us. The thing is, we're wondering what we get back from God if we believe. What are Allah's promises for the believers? You see, brothers and sisters, what happens is God has already given us all of the talent we need to survive and to do well. God has already given you and I everything we need to succeed. What holds us back? What keeps us from being a powerhouse? Not having hope. We give up on ourselves. Many people never live up to their full potential. They never discover their talents. They settle for being mediocre. Even if they remain on the path of Islam, they're not those believers that the Imam is looking for. All of us are insan. All of us are human beings. What does God say about human beings? This is what he says over there. أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمِ We created man in the best form. Already, as a believer, yes, the verse does mention after that. Some believers, some people don't use those talents. They destroy themselves. That's something else. But we, as human beings, have been created in the best form. We're already there. We already have all those talents. It's just a matter of now applying what's already there. There's something else that stops mu'mineen and mu'minat from living and flourishing, from having that wonderful relationship with God. There's another thing that holds some believers back. It's the difference between those who are mediocre and those who excel. One thing that robs us of joy and robs us of hope is sometimes our past. There are mu'mineen and mu'minat, people who want to desperately get close to God, to experience that wonderful relationship of being close to him, knowing he's on their side. Man kana lillah, kana Allahu la. But what? I think I've made too many mistakes. I've done dumb things. I've made sometimes terrible sins. Things I'm ashamed of. If other people knew about me, they would hold their heads. They wouldn't look me in the face. Right? And I'm aware of those things, aware of those sins. That guilty feeling, that guilty conscience, the things I know about myself is keeping me from experiencing God's best. And that's not supposed to happen, brothers and sisters. In order for us to experience God's best, brothers and sisters, we don't have to have a perfect past. It's not necessary that I be the perfect mu'min ever in the past, and if that's not there, I can never be at those highest ranks and amongst the best of the best. No, even if I've had a past, I can still experience Allah's best. This is very important, brothers and sisters. Keep this in mind. Life, as you know, is a long journey. There are ups and downs in life. If there's a person, think about this, there's a person who's going on a very long trip, but in his mind or her mind, this is in the back of my mind, if I make even one slip, then it's all over. And then let's say the person does slip, because who's perfect? The person does slip. And then now I'm almost obsessed with not making another mistake, because that doesn't even make it worse. I'm so worried. If I make a mistake, it can never be forgiven. A person who's like that, so worried in that way, I can never forget my past. It can never be right. I can never be good. This person will end up abandoning traveling. They weren't going to go on that trip. I'm hopeless about the past, suspicious of the future. This kind of believer, how will they even travel? What keeps them going? But let's say I knew that my mistakes, no matter what they were, if I make tawbah, if I'm regretful, God can fix it for me. It doesn't have to be that I'm condemned. I made a mistake and now God got out his marker and he crossed my name off the list. If I knew that, how much hope would I have?
لا شريك له
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the post-forgiveness process. We talked a little bit in the previous segment about how we need to recalibrate, right? So once we have sought the forgiveness of the Almighty Allah, now we're at this kind of ground zero, if you will. We have purified ourselves. Now we have to be on guard. We have to be very careful that we don't fall into the same sin again. And this is where that pre-sin process comes in that we talked about in a previous episode. We have to see why it is that we're falling into a sin, what catalysts are there, what initiators are there that are pushing us towards sin. And again, we need to prevent ourselves from being in a situation where we are going to be falling into committing sins. And so this disobedience of the Almighty Allah can be reduced in this manner, right? So, I don't know, if we start to go into examples, then the program is not going to allow it as far as time is concerned. You know, but for example, we find ourselves not being able to wake up, for example, for the morning prayers. Well, are we sleeping on time? You know, are we sleeping early? Are we reciting a dua in order to wake up on time? Are we sleeping with a, you know, full stomach or an empty stomach? What are we doing before we go to sleep? Are we doing any du'as before we go to sleep? Are we setting the alarm? If the alarm is too close to the bed, you know, that we turn it off or we put it on snooze, should we put the alarm farther away? Right? It's all a work in process. It is all to analyze, see what happens, recalibrate, and keep moving forward. This is this post-forgiveness state, to be on guard, to not fall into the same sin over and over again. Now, of course, because it is a work in process, there are times where we will continuously be falling into the same sin or into similar sins, and this should not make us despair. It should not make us feel hopeless. It should not make us give up. This in itself is a test, is to see how many times an individual will fall but will get back up and keep moving forward. This is a part of the process. And sometimes the process is painful because the more you fall down, the more it hurts. But still, the beauty of it lies in an individual being able to get back up and keep moving forward. And so this process is a continuous process. Certain sins might take an individual a whole lifetime to be able to cure. The point is to continuously work hard to try to achieve it and to continuously pray to the Almighty Allah and to seek the intercession and the intermediation of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, the infallibles and the immaculates and the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, to help us in these various sins that are in our lives. Never give up, keep on moving forwards, pray to the Almighty Allah, and inshallah, this will improve, increase, strengthen, purify our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
The Trump administration has ordered U.S. states to suspend a $5 billion electric vehicle charging station program in a further blow to the environmental movement. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The Trump administration has ordered U.S. states to suspend a $5 billion electric vehicle charging station program in a further blow to the environmental movement since the president's return to the White House. In a memo issued on Thursday, 6th of February, to state transportation directors, the Transportation Department's Federal Highway Administration ordered states not to suspend any funds allocated to them under the Biden administration as part of the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. Emily Biondi, the Federal Highway Administration's Associate Administrator for Planning, Environment and Realty, wrote in the memo, "The new leadership of the Department of Transportation has decided to review the policies underlying the implementation of the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program." Emily Biondi added, "Accordingly, the current National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program, dated June 11, 2024, and all prior versions of this guidance are rescinded." She wrote, "As a result of rescission of the NEVI Formula Program guidance, the Federal Highway Administration is also immediately suspending the approval of all state electric vehicle infrastructure deployment plans for all fiscal years. Therefore, effective immediately, no new obligations may occur under the NEVI Formula Program until the updated fiscal NEVI Formula Program guidance is issued and new state plans are submitted and approved." Emily Biondi added that until new guidance is issued, reimbursement of existing obligations for designing and building charging stations will be allowed in order to prevent the disruption of current financial commitments. According to an existing page on the Energy Department's website, the NEVI program provides funding to states to strategically deploy electric vehicle chargers. Funding is available for up to 80% of eligible project costs, including the acquisition, installation, and network connection of electric vehicle chargers, proper operation and maintenance of electric vehicle chargers, and long-term electric vehicle charger data sharing. The website Politico reports that as of Thursday, 6th of February, the FHWA removed several website pages that provided information on the NEVI program. In a statement to the website Politico, Andrew Rogers, the former deputy FHWA administrator under the Biden administration, said that the memo appears to ignore both the law and multiple restraining orders that have been issued by federal courts. The outlet further reports that Andrew Rogers, saying that the memo appears to be in direct violation of the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, a law that restricts presidents from withholding congressionally approved funding. According to Electric Vehicle States Clearinghouse, currently 14 states have at least one operational electric vehicle station. According to a NEVI report, as of last November, there are 126 public charging ports in operation across 31 NEVI stations in 9 states, marking an 83% increase in open NEVI ports since last quarter. It added that a total of 41 states have released at least their first round of solicitations, with 35 having issued conditional awards or put agreements in place for more than 3,560 fast charging ports across more than 890 charging station locations. Throughout his campaign, Donald Trump railed against electric vehicles, at one point saying that supporters of the vehicles should rot in hell, and that Joe Biden's support for electric vehicles would bring a bloodbath to the United States' automotive industry. Last month, as part of a flurry of executive orders he signed during his first days back in office, Donald Trump revoked the Biden-era order from 2021 that had aimed to make half of all new vehicles sold in the United States by 2030 electric vehicles. The website of Press Reader has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump's attempts to slash incentives for electric cars would cause sales of the vehicles to plummet, with this effort cheered on by the seemingly confounding supporter Elon Musk, the billionaire chief executive of Tesla. Trump has said that he will revoke the electric vehicle mandate, saving our auto industry and keeping my sacred pledge to our great American auto workers. President Trump, who previously suggested supporters of electric vehicles rot in hell before somewhat tempering his rhetoric, has already ditched an aspirational goal for half of all car sales to be electric vehicles by the end of the decade, halted some funding for electric vehicle chargers, and began reversing vehicle pollution standards that prod auto companies to shift away from gasoline models. A key tax credit for Americans buying an electric vehicle worth up to $7,500 is also a major target for elimination, although to overturn this, Donald Trump will require Republicans in Congress. Should he succeed, though, the impact would be significant, with a current study finding that electric car sales could fall by as much as 27% without the incentive. Joseph Shapiro, a University of California at Berkeley economist and co-author of the study, said, "Turning off the credit would affect a meaningful share of electric vehicle market," adding that while a growing number of people would still go electric, the total number of cars sold would shrink by more than 300,000 a year than if the incentive stayed in place. Joseph Shapiro added, "You could say that it would be a speed bump in the road, but if the US goes all electric in 2090 rather than 2050, say, that matters a lot for the planet. A lot of carbon would be emitted in that time." Donald Trump's agenda has been enthusiastically backed by Elon Musk, despite the market-leading electric vehicle company Tesla that also relies upon some parts made in China that may be targeted by tariffs imposed by Trump. Though Elon Musk has said that removal of electric vehicle subsidies will hurt rivals such as Ford and General Motors more than Tesla. Elon Musk wrote on X, "Take away the subsidies. It will only help Tesla." Joseph Shapiro claimed, "There is some logic to this. Tesla is comfortably the largest electric vehicle brand in the United States, accounting for nearly half of all sales, and makes more profit per car than its rivals, meaning the removal of incentives would be disproportionately felt by other electric vehicle manufacturers." Joseph Shapiro added, "If the tax credit is removed, Tesla could survive and have less competition. They have more headroom to withstand a decrease in the market size." Stocks in Tesla surged following Donald Trump's election win. However, Tesla will still be affected. For example, weakening federal pollution rules could see a reduction in the amount of carbon credits Tesla sells to other car companies, amounting to $2.7 billion just last year, to offset their emissions and avoid fines. Tesla sales dipped slightly for the first time in 2024 amid concerns among some of its traditionally liberal customer base about Elon Musk's rightward political turn.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli drone strike kills 3 civilians in southern Lebanon in another blatant violation of the ceasefire agreement with the Arab country. Thousands of protesters take to the streets across the occupied territories calling on the Israeli regime to complete the captive exchange deal with Hamas. And Israeli forces attack the houses of recently freed Palestinian abductees as the regime steps up its crackdown on Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. Thank you for joining us. The Israeli regime has committed fresh violations of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon, killing and injuring a number of civilians in the southern part of the country. According to the Lebanese media, an Israeli drone targeted a vehicle on the Jarju Road in the Iklim Al-Tufa area, killing 3 Lebanese civilians and injuring 4 others. The report added that the drone fired a guided missile at the civilian vehicle. Another car was caught in the blast radius of the explosion, injuring 4 women. The regime claimed that the attack targeted a senior member of the Hezbollah resistance movement. The ceasefire entered into force last November after more than a year of Israeli aggression on Lebanon. It obligated Israel to withdraw from southern Lebanon over a 60-day period, but the regime refused to fulfill its obligations and the deadline was extended until February 18th. Israel has repeatedly violated the deal and its strikes have killed and injured many Lebanese civilians. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in several areas across the occupied territories demanding the completion of the captive exchange deal with Hamas. In Tel Aviv, demonstrators protested the regime's ceasefire violations and obstructions. They called on the regime's cabinet to complete the captive exchange deal. Similar protests were held in the Haifa area and the Lower Galilee. Gaza-based resistance groups have repeatedly complained about Israel's violations, threatening to halt the deal. Since the beginning of the Israeli genocide in Gaza, the regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been blamed for mishandling the war by protesters who have repeatedly called on him to resign. The first phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal is to last 42 days. The two sides are yet to negotiate the second phase of the agreement. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has published a video of its most recent release of Israeli captives held in Gaza. The footage shows Gaza resistance fighters handing 3 Israeli captives over to the Red Cross. Resistance fighters paraded the captives onto a stage in Gaza's southern city of Khan Yunis, where the Israelis addressed the crowd before the handover. The 3 men warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that time is running out and urged the Israeli cabinet to adhere to the completion of further exchanges of captives under the ceasefire deal. The Israeli captives were released on Saturday. Buses carrying the freed Palestinians have arrived at Khan Yunis as the 6th stage of the prisoners' exchange deal between the Hamas resistance movement and the Israeli regime is carried out. To document their arrival, our Gaza correspondent Abu Bakr Abed went to the European hospital where he talked to some of the freed Gazans.
A moment of joy, a moment of happiness, as 333 Palestinian detainees have arrived from Israeli jails in the European hospital in Khan Yunis. After experiencing every sort of torture and enduring unthinkable horrors, some have been blindfolded and beaten for weeks, others were left in cages.